Succession number 28495, Reel 7.
Albert Hughes, Reel 7.
Right. Night flying. This was largely... we started off, first of all, by doing circuits and landings. That's obviously the first thing to learn. And because we were flying on a fairly simple airfield with runways, but the runways were not essentially used because we could also land on the sandy surfaces. But they would lay out a flare path, a flare pots, sort of metal pots, which if were knocked over would correct themselves, and they'd be filled with material soaked up and burning paraffin. The control would no longer be in the tower because we didn't have radio in the steerman, so there'd be a little van at the end of the landing strip to give instructions for takeoff and landing. It was relatively straightforward because you'd only do it in decent weather and without too much wind. And the landing at night was almost as easy as daytime landing, particularly since although the airfield was out in the country, there was sufficient artificial light to give you an horizon to fly by anyway. There's an interesting incident here. I was with an instructor, and the aeroplane in front of us was just about to go onto the runway to take off, and I saw an aircraft landing. The aircraft going onto the runway had been given a green light to take off onto the runway. The aircraft landing had not been seen by the controller. It landed on top of the aircraft trying to take off. Because it was going faster, it struck the top of the aircraft on the ground, did a forward somersault, and landed on the ground in front of the first aircraft, and then the two stopped together. My instructor just leapt out and ran, leaving me having to sit holding the brakes, because there were no, with the foot brakes, there wasn't handbrake. And I sat there praying, no fire. There wasn't any, I was lucky. The four people involved get off very lightly. It was the pilot in the landing aircraft who had his nose broken. That's all he had. It's rather a pity because he was a very handsome bloke and he spoiled his appearance. But at any rate, he realised, and we all realised, that had there been a fire, there'd be no hope. And because the petrol tank was on the top, he must have struck the petrol tank of one aeroplane and landed with his petrol tank scraping the ground. Okay, now the next exercise, number 37, overshoot procedure. Again, this is under instructor controls. You're making a normal landing and the instructor will give you the order to overshoot. You don't know when he was going to tell you. You could be almost on the ground or you could be a decent height, but he'd say overshoot, and you then have to open up the throttle to take off power and just go around and do the circuit and try again. In the case of a steerman, this is a simple matter, but in the case of aircraft with retractable undercarriages and flaps and the things for trimming, you have to do a lot of things at once before you can safely do an overshoot. Perhaps you could mention that at a later stage. Check ride.
What was the last thing there? Check ride?
Check ride. Well, this is now at the end of this particular session of training on this particular aircraft. The instructor will have satisfied himself that you're ready to be checked out, But you've got to meet that standard within a limited number of hours. You can't go on indefinitely. You are strictly rationed. So the check ride will be carried out by possibly a senior civilian instructor or possibly by an RAF person. And in my case, I think this must have been my check ride, Mr. Mitchell. So he's a civilian. This would be a little before the end of the session on the Stearman, which is the PT, Primary Trainer 17A. And so at the end of these number of hours, I came to the end of my training on that particular aircraft.
So when you'd done that training, you did that whole sequence of instructions on the Stearman first?
Yes, all that on the Stearman, yes. Now, you don't have to do it all on the Harvard completely. You see, you can cut out a few. You'll do most of it, but not in so much detail.
And was it all under instruction the whole of the time? Were you under instruction the whole of the time you were in the Stearman, or were you?
Oh no, we did a decent amount of solo. You see, I did 34 hours solo as a pilot.
What would you do? Would you be given a task to do?
Oh yes.
Or would you have a certain amount of free time to practice
things? No, you would be given written instructions, a sheet, telling you what your duties were. And see, my last exercise in the Stearman, I was doing circuits, aerobatic slow rolls, intermans, and loops. Nearly an hour doing that. It's hard work.
How physical is it to fly an aircraft?
Difficult. It isn't really. In some ways it's easier than driving on the roads because you've got so much more to do. You've got more to think about in the aircraft, but there are difficulties. One of the most difficult things is the landing. Taking off is not too difficult. I found it pretty easy in the sense that you could do it with confidence. And with confidence, once you got accustomed to the aircraft, you could throw it about doing aerobatics.
Is that physically tiring?
Oh, yes. Yes. You're not aware of it at the time because you're doing a lot of physical work. But there's also some sort of, if you like, psychological effect as well. But physically, a fair amount of work, even with the Stearman, and sometimes the trainer can be more work than a more powerful aircraft with better controls and so on.
So you would finish your section, you would be checked out on the Stearman, and
yes,
then go on to the Harvard.
That's right.
What type of training would you do on that? Because you said you didn't do everything again, really.
Not everything, no. But before starting on the new aircraft, you've got to learn the aircraft, learn the cockpit drill, study the notes, and you have all these things which you've got to learn and sign that you've learned them. So you have to certify that you've been instructed and understand petrol, oil, aircraft controls, emergency hydraulics, action in the event of fire, abandoning aircraft, restarting engine in flight. I've got to know all of those. I may not have actually practiced the restarting yet, but I know how to do it in theory, and later on I'll practice it with the instructor. And see, again, it's fairly straightforward at the beginning. Introduction, effective controls, straight and level, climbing, descending, taxiing, circuits, and so on.
So, in a sense, it follows the same pattern?
Same pattern.
But the Harvard is a much more advanced aircraft.
Yes. Now, the Tiger Moth, I don't know its horsepower, but I think it may have been about 120, something like that. The Stearman was 220. The North American Harvard was 550. It's more than double. A much bigger, much heavier aeroplane with retractable undercarriage and flaps and things like that.
Mm. And a monoplane as well, because obviously the two that you've
It's a monoplane. Yes, that's right. Yes, yes.
Can you give me a brief description of the Harvard, a sort of verbal description of the aircraft? Do you remember it?
Well, it's a radial engine. And it's a Pratt & Whitney. They made good radial engines. And it would be a single row of probably perhaps seven cylinders, I'm not sure now. A long cabin, twin seat, with separate entrances for pilot and instructor or navigator. I think we said it's a monoplane.
Was it more complex, the cockpit layout?
Oh, yes. Well, the cockpit layout of the Harvard is nearly as complicated as a Spitfire, because now you've got all the extra instruments, including even the bomb. The machine gun control there, some of them were used operationally, and there are several instruments which depend upon the use of gyroscopes to help the flying. You now had a variable pitch for the propeller. You could vary the propeller speed, something like changing your gear. The undercarriage was retractable hydraulically. There's so much more to think about in this. The interesting thing is you get to see the pattern. If something is wrong, you see it instantly. And of course, there are certain things that you're looking at constantly all the time. Altimeter, rate of climb, which is new on this. Engine temperature, hydraulic pressure, artificial horizon, turn and bank indicator. The compass is down here, that's the magnetic compass, but the gyroscopic compass is there, central to the eye. It's much bigger. It's almost as big and complicated as a Spitfire or a Mustang.
So obviously, once you familiarise yourself with the cockpit, how would that be done? How would you familiarise yourself with it? Would you familiarise yourself with the cockpit?
Well, initially, you'd be given the notes, and you go and sit in an aircraft and you study it, and you talk to people. Before you ever started going off with an instructor, you had to be completely familiar with it at a very early age, know where all the controls were, as well as all the extra instrumentation. It's too expensive to learn it in the air. It's much cheaper to do it on the ground. In the pilot's room, if there isn't an aircraft doing nothing. But if ever there was an aircraft doing nothing, you could always get permission to go out and do that.
And before you actually took off in a flight with an instructor, would you do a series of checks on the aircraft?
Yes. You were taught to do this. You'd walk all the way around it. You'd look at the tyres. You'd give them a kick. Didn't tell you much because they're hard as iron. But you did. You always give them a kick. And you'd walk around looking for damage, any sign of damage. There wasn't much more you could do on the outside, but once you got in the aircraft, it didn't matter how often you'd been in it before, you always moved the controls and looked to make sure they worked the right way. There were cases where they'd been reversed in maintenance, and sometimes the pilot discovered when he was taking off, you see. Not the best time to discover it. So it looks elementary, but you did that automatically. And of course, you always made sure that you had a full tank of petrol. That's essential.
And if you were doing it with an instructor, would he check as well? Or would you
Yes, but mainly he'd watch you checking. And of course, since these planes were in use, you know, one after the other after the other, they were hard worked. Any damage would have been reported, presumably by the other pilot. And when we come to deck landings, I'll tell you of an incident where I had to report it.
Right, so we're in the pattern of work in Harvard, and you've described some of the initial things that you did, which were very similar to what you'd done on the steamer and the tight one.
Yeah.
Was there anything else, though, that you would do with the Harvard that was slightly different?
Yes. You could do approach and landing without flaps. You're coming in much faster now. Because with flaps, let's say you could cruise at 120, and let's say you're stalling at about 80, you'd have to be landing significantly above 80 miles an hour with flaps. If you didn't have flaps, you might have to do it at 100. It's much faster. You need more space. And that's got here, approach and landing without flaps. Again, you do an overshoot procedure. But the overshoot procedure now was more complicated because you've got an undercarriage to retract, and you've also got trimming. The trimming means that at different speeds and different engine powers, the forces on the rudder and ailerons vary. And they can get to the stage where it's very difficult to move, almost beyond your control. So each control surface has a subsidiary little flap which can be set to counteract these forces. So you'll have certain settings for takeoff because you've got high power, slow speed. And this certainly affects rudder and elevator. Landing, it doesn't matter because you have already, in flying, adjusted the trim to suit normal flying, which is okay for landing. But if you are suddenly in an overshoot procedure and you open up the throttle to full power quickly, you've then got to alter the trimming. Otherwise, you're having to fight the control surfaces. And this is even more so in the Corsair deck landing.
Did you do any gunnery or bombing practice at this stage?
No. No bombing, no gunnery. It was purely learning to fly the aircraft. Yes.
How did you like flying the Harvard? How did you like flying the Harvard?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. And the more power, you could do aerobatics and maintain height just about. You couldn't gain height, but you could maintain it. But, see, we were doing an awful lot of things like aerobatics, solo flying, and then with the instructor, lots more taking off circuits, approaching landings. This was continuing all the time. Again here, self, stalling, stick turns, aerobatics, slips, slow rolls. We're not doing quite so much spinning in this, but we certainly do some.
What about spinning in the Harvard in comparison, say, with a Tiger Moth or a Stearman?
Well, it falls, it loses height very rapidly. So, and you must have plenty of height to do it safely. Again, we did practice this business of being able to control the spin so you could do a precision spin. You could stop it in a precise direction, which gave you confidence to know that you were in control of the aircraft, completely in control.
And was much more of your time in the Harvard spent on your own rather than with an instructor?
It was roughly equal because now, you see, having done the basics, learning to fly, we're now going into a session, we're doing cross-country flying with an instructor. And you would do a session with cross-country flying and then a session flying alone. This continues down this page. But now we're doing instrument flying circuits.
So it's really a repetition of what you did with the Stearman, but on another aircraft. It's much more powerful.
At a much more... yes, that's right.
One thing you mentioned is the retractable undercarriage on a Harvard. At first, was that a problem getting used to the fact that you had a retractable undercarriage, or was there a warning if you hadn't lowered it or raised
you,
it?
You had to remember to lower it. Now, I think there would be a warning. I think if you close the throttle a certain distance to look to landing power and the undercarriage was still retracted, you'd probably get a warning. And there's a classic quotation in one of the RAF books about the Spitfire pilot who landed with his wheels up, and the controller said, "Why on earth didn't you listen to my warning? I was telling you." The pilot said, "I couldn't hear the warning. There's that buzzer in my ears." Now, I don't know if it's true, but it could be. You see that TM? Have you met TM? Well, during the war, TM was a monthly RAF monthly magazine training manual, which went right through the war. That's a facsimile reproduction of the whole series. There's about 4 years of training manuals in there. It's classic. It's available in Australia. My daughter got it for me.
So, with the training as it continued on, were you beginning to feel very confident as a pilot?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes, I was fairly confident. And, of course, now we're doing cross-country flying solo as well as with the instructor. And, again, on the Harvard, we're doing instrument flying and cross-country flying on the Harvard. And... are we taping something? No? Yes. So, see, the sessions are running close to an hour, and these are all, many of them are cross-country. Here, I'm taking a navigator with me, one of my colleagues, Jay Johns, is the navigator. On another occasion, I'll be the navigator, and someone else will be the pilot. It's still a mixture of general flying practice together with cross-country flying. Certainly.
Did you do any formation flying at all?
Yes, if we just come to it. Formation three ship. That's the standard. And the wings were overlapping. It was close formation.
So how do you formate on another aircraft? How would you do that?
Well, you have to concentrate because you're close. And certainly the wings would be overlapping in that respect. And this close formation flying meant the leader was the guide. He was flying three aeroplanes. The other two formating on him could do nothing but watch him. And you're doing this all the time. The wings were so close, and you couldn't look anywhere else. Now, before the war, this is where the RAF flew it, close formation, with 3, 9, and they thought that was the way to do it. So they go into battle with maybe a large number of aeroplanes, but only one person could see. It took them a long time to learn that that was stupid. A long time. The Germans had learned it in Spain. But eventually they discovered that tactical, operational flying, you must be well apart. 100 yards is close. And then you can manoeuvre because everybody can see what he's doing. So we did this formation flying, but it's just more or less straight and level formation with some turns. And we did quite a bit there, you see, an hour at a time.
Again, is it a good confidence booster, the formation
flying? It is, yes.
Is that really what a lot of that would be for? Is it really just to show you had control of the aircraft and that you're confident?
I think it's partly that, yes.
Because I'm thinking about the stage of the war that you're at in 43, after having what you've just said, a lot of the formation had gone out of things, hadn't it?
But That's right.
If it was meant as a sort of good example of how you can fly and your skills and your confidence.
I think that had a lot to do with it. Yes, we would also do formation takeoff and formation landing, which in operations is totally unnecessary, but it's useful confidence building. And this continues at the same pattern, including now night flying, both night flying circuits and bumps, and then night cross-country flying.
How did that differ?
It was relatively easy in the sense that visibility was always good in Arizona, of course, and although we're flying over desert, which didn't have much light on it, there's sufficient light in the distance to give you an horizon. So the instrument flying was relatively easy, and we would perhaps fly to another place, another town, perhaps to a third, making a triangle before flying back. There's one important thing, though, about night flying. The height of the airfield at Mesa was 1,200 feet. For normal flying, you set the altimeter at zero. So when you came back from local flying, you just dropped down to 1,000 feet. You were 1,000 feet above the ground, and you land. Now, for a cross country, you should set the airfield height at 1,200 feet. So if you had to land anywhere else, all you needed to know what their height was and act accordingly. Now, we had one or two fatal accidents, and it's almost certain that what they'd done was they'd set the altimeter at 1,000 feet. They'd gone off and done a cross-country, and tried to get down. Wait a moment now, let me think it out. And they tried to get down to 1,000 feet, which was lower than the height of the airfield, you see. I did it in daylight. I did a cross-country in daylight, and I'd not sort the altimeter correctly. And I was coming back, and I was losing height in gay abandon, beautiful sunny day. And I thought those cactus plants looked big. And I looked at the altimeter, it was about, say, 200 feet. That's funny. I thought, I'll see how low I can get. I went very low, but I couldn't get to 1,000 feet. I was lucky. But people who did it in the dark didn't. There were one or two cases of that. We did a lot of night flying at this time, as you can see.
So you used camera guns there? You used some camera guns at that stage?
Oh, where are we now? Yes, we did camera guns, but we weren't firing. This was air to air. And we then began to do some, if you like, dogfight practice between two aircraft, which were camera guns were becoming useful. So we were practicing elementary aerial combat, dogfighting type. I remember one flight like this from Falcon to Tucson to Phoenix. It was a long flight, and we just had enough petrol to do it, so we weren't doing any landing. You had to make sure you had a full tank. And over Tucson, it was extremely busy because it was a turning point, and it looked as though half the aeroplanes in America were all turning over there, because I got over my turning point, and there were aeroplanes everywhere. I was scared. I was glad we didn't have to land, and I immediately got out, away from it. We did make a similar journey in daytime once, where we did land, but we didn't switch off because of petrol consideration. We just landed, turned around, took off and flew back again. But night flying, you did have to keep your eye open for the navigation lights of other aircraft, and we were flying with navigation lights on, of course, there.